Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back on Tuesday. At the annual National Institute of Justice conference yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder said the importance of rigorous, cutting-edge research has never been clearer. One area of research getting fresh attention is the relationship between genes and criminal behaviour. Joining me in the studio to discuss DNA research and criminology are John Lobb, Director of the National Institute of Justice, and Benson George Cook, President of the Association of Black Psychologists. John Paul Wright from the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice joins us from a studio. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. Of course, you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. We would love to hear you. Fascinating subject, gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming in. Let me start with you, Dr. John Paul Wright. Why have historically criminologists been so reluctant to study whether there is a genetic cause to crime?
Well, I think you have to understand a little bit of the history of criminology. Criminology was a subfield of sociology for a very long time, and at some point in the past, biological theorizing was linked with Nazi efforts, with racism, with all sorts of sort of nasty social and cultural policies, including the eugenics movement. And I think that set a very sour taste in the discipline's mind for a very long time.
In terms of what is now prompting the new research?
Well, what's prompting the new research, I think, is, first of all, data. We now have large data sets, both of twins, of extended families, of children of twins, data sets that also include direct measures of genes that we've never, ever had before. And it's allowing us to ask questions that we've never been able to ask before, and to provide some empirical assessment of biological influences. The other thing that has changed is the technology has rapidly allowed us to both genotype people at a cost that's no longer exorbitant, as well as conduct imaging studies that are now very revealing. So you really have this amalgamation of data and technology that have allowed us to move in this direction. It's no longer speculation. It's no longer simply built off of correlation. We have various methods now at our disposal to assess biological hypotheses.
You mentioned the Second World War when I asked you why there had been this historic reluctance to study genetic causes of crime. And I was just wondering whether we are also seeing a generational shift amongst criminologists.
We may be. My colleagues and I talk about this quite a bit. The new generation of criminologists are not afraid of technology. They've grown up in the area of genomics, of advances in molecular genetics. I think it's not as scary as it once was, especially when you start to delve into it and you realize how complicated it really is. So I think that the younger generation of criminologists are more inclined to look at issues like this.
Dr. John Lobb, first of all, congratulations. You've received the 2011 Stockholm Prize in Criminology. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Great honor for you.
Yes,
tell us a bit of your research.
Well, our research has been a long-term study that's looked at how crime occurs across various phases of life, starting in childhood through adolescence into the full length of adulthood. In fact, with Robert Sampson, we have what we believe to be the largest longitudinal study of offenders anywhere in the world. So we have data on 500 juvenile delinquents that were followed beginning at age 14, and we followed them to age 70.
And did you learn anything about the issue of inheritance in this?
Well, we, and again, Dr. Wright's quite right that the research during the 1940s and 1950s and indeed into the 60s that tried to look at biological measures used very crude measures of biology. And so we were not able to look at many of the things that he was talking about in that study. But nonetheless, we do have a number of characteristics that people believe are linked to have a biological basis. For instance, we were able to look at early childhood impulsivity, early childhood hyperactivity, things like that. And I think for us, these kinds of factors may set an individual on a particular path, we believe that there are multiple pathways to crime, and we believe more importantly there are multiple pathways out of crime. And what we won the prize for was really our research looking at how it is offenders stop offending in later life.
Dr. Benson Cook, you've expressed some concern about any linking of genetics to criminal behavior.
Well, based upon the article that was in the New York Times, it reported that about 20 years ago, the Association of Black Psychologists held a position. As the current president, I'd probably say there are three major points that must be reconciled. The first is, who's doing the research? While we're talking about moving into the next generation, the reality is we're still using a scientific approach that if you don't have people sitting at the table who represent a diverse worldview or a diverse cultural sensitivity and degree of competence, then you're going to run into some problems with what the outcome is going to be. The second is, what's going to be the experimental design? In many instances, if we're looking at who the control group is, for example, that would be the norm. So what's the norm based upon versus what the control experimental group, this is the one that deviates from the norm, you're probably going to get deficit modeling. In that context, research that's been done using European Americans or whites as the norm basically results in African Americans looking pathological. That's been a concern of the Association of Black Psychologists. And then finally, the sample group. If you're looking at research from people who have been incarcerated, whether at the juvenile or at the adult level, and you take into consideration that the majority of those that are incarcerated are African Americans. And men. Automatically, you're going to have some serious problems. Right. It's a slippery slope.
So you're saying that basically the research can never be accurate enough to be valid?
I'm saying it's going to be important that you have people sitting at the table who represent the groups that are currently being highlighted as having some serious
problems. Is it research, though, that you'd like to see done, or in general that you think criminologists should steer away from?
Well, I think there's some other points that are really important. One is to really define, when we're talking about crime, what kind of crime. For example, if you're looking at some of the work that's been done by Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, she highlights the fact that in many instances you have individuals who, if they're using, for example, powder cocaine, face a lower sentence of time versus those who are using crack. Same product, but socially and legally, there's this difference.
We're looking at a different group of people. Yes. Okay, well, let me go back to you, Dr. John Paul Wright, because you have done some research on this. And bearing in mind what Dr. Cook was just saying, tell us a little bit about the research that you've done amongst adopted children and crime there.
Well, we've engaged in a full battery of studies, if you will. One was looking at children that had been adopted. And we've known since at least the 1970s that children that are adopted generally, but not always, turn out looking more like their biological parents than their adopted parents. Now, this is, I believe, some of Mednick's work in the 70s showed this and has since continued. I would say that the other side of that coin is that there's also clear evidence that adoption into dysfunctional families seems to increase whatever propensities or aggressive propensities a child may have.
So I'm right
so
in thinking that
interaction.
I'm right mm-hmm. in thinking that you found that adopted children whose biological parents had committed a crime were significantly more likely to be arrested than adoptees whose biological parents had never been arrested. So it was not question of being adopted and the issues that might raise. It was the environment in which they were placed.
Yes, both. It's with adoption, the adoption studies in general show that if the parents had been arrested, the biological parents had been arrested, then the child has a priori higher risk of being arrested later in life. Again, I think it's important to draw out that if the child is placed in a home where parents are also being arrested, the adopted parents are also being arrested, that seems to aggravate the situation. So in our minds, at least, there's clear evidence that these things interact.
Dr. John Loeb, what do you make of that research?
Well, I think that, I agree with Dr. Wright in the sense that most of the better work looking at genes and crime are looking at the interaction between genes and then the environment. And it seems to me, from a scientific standpoint, we need to be open to the possibility that there is a genetic basis for a predisposition or a propensity to be involved in crime. But at the same time, the question is, what it is about the environment then that influences the later development of criminal behavior. And it seems to me we cannot reduce our analyses to simply say, well, there's this genetic basis, and not really focus on the wide range of environment, because I think our work shows the power of the environment. And as a social scientist, I'm not afraid of genetics, because I believe in the long run it's going to suggest a small part of the larger problem of trying to understand this very complex behavior known as crime. Because one of the things we've learned over the last 25 years is it comes from multiple sources.
Okay, we'll discuss those sources, mm-hmm. predisposition, and the triggers that there might be in this just after this short break. Dr. John Loeb joins me here in the studio. Dr. Benson George Cook is also here. John Paul Wright, Professor of Criminal Justice, joins us down the line. We'll take your calls, questions, and comments later on in the program. Please do stay with us. We're going to have a quick break. Welcome back. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our discussion on criminology and genetics and whether there are links between the two. New research coming out. I am joined here in the studio by Dr. John Loeb. He's from the director of the National Institute of Justice at the U.S. Department of Justice. Dr. Benson George Cook, president of the Association of Black Psychologists, is with me in the studio as well. John Paul Wright, professor of criminal justice at the University of Cincinnati, joins us down the line. And we also have with us down the line John Butler, who is the leader of Applied Genetics Group at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Mr. Butler, thank you very much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
You're welcome.
You've done a lot of work on DNA databases and actually keeping genetic records. What's the new thinking on databases, and how do databases differ from data banks?
So a DNA database is just the storage of a DNA profile, which contains a computer file with specific information from DNA. For forensic testing, there's 13 specific sites right now that are tested in the U.S. within the human genome that measure the length of DNA at those sites. A data bank is a storage of samples, so biological specimens that could be then tested for use into a database.
And how are they used forensically, these DNA samples?
Well, when you have an unknown profile from a crime scene, that can then be searched against a storage of DNA profiles from previously convicted offenders that are present in the database based on laws that have been, you know, from various states, that they'll include their DNA database profiles.
Mr. Butler, we're talking this hour about the links between, or possible links between, genetics and criminal behaviour. How do you think that the kind of DNA databases that you're building up and that are being built up in the States affect the research into that? What do they tell us about those links?
Really nothing, because the DNA profiles that are used for forensic purposes do not store any information related to ethnicity, so there's really, or anything else. So there's nothing that, all it stores is a basic, just a series of numbers that are useful for, just similar to a social security number that could specifically identify an individual.
And yet, they're not totally uncontroversial, are they? Because there is an argument from critics that current DNA databases maintained by the FBI might be skewed by virtue of where you collect the DNA from.
No, the DNA samples that are collected and stored within a DNA database are based on what the individuals that come into the criminal justice system. So offenders that, if they're either arrested, depending on what the state law is, or previously convicted, those are the profiles that are then put into the database.
Mr. Butler, I have in the studio Dr. Benson George Cook. He's the president of the Association of Black Psychologists, and I'd like to bring him in on this conversation, Dr. Cook.
Okay, in the context of using the database and data bank for forensic purposes, I mean, I think everyone listening has probably seen CSI or other episodes and recognizes the value of that information and correctly identifying people to some offense that takes place. I think that's very different than talking about the genetics as a basis for determining, you know, who a criminal might be. In a New York Times article, for example, the two questions that were raised that I think were very appropriate is, should a genetic predisposition influence sentencing? I think that could be problematic, leading to a slippery slope. And another is, could genetic tests be used to tailor rehabilitation programs to individual criminals? And that would have to be looked at carefully. And the key point that I want to reiterate going back to again is, who's sitting at the table when these decisions are being made scientifically about how to approach it? And what population is the norm around which the results are being formulated?
So would you say that there were any possible disadvantages for having a national DNA database?
Well, in the context of forensic purposes, I have no problem with that. I'm speaking of it in the context of saying, okay, now we're going to have a marker for being able to determine, you know, who could potentially be a criminal from childhood up.
And Mr. Butler, you think that couldn't happen with the databases as they currently stand?
As they currently stand, no. So they're just forensic tools to help identify unknown crime scene profiles.
Okay, John Butler, leader of the Applied Genetics Group at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
You're welcome.
Let's get back to this discussion just before the break. John Loeb, you were talking about this idea of predisposition. I think this is very interesting, and whether people might have a predisposition that we could see from some kind of genetic research towards a crime. And the question then would be, what would be the trigger? Because somebody could have a predisposition towards aggressive behavior and go on to become CEO of a major company and channel their predisposition that way, presumably.
Presumably. But also, I think there's a larger issue here, and it's linked to how one views development. And what I'm concerned about when we look at the role of genetics in criminal behavior in particular is, it seems as if they're looking at development as simply this unfolding or unrolling of something that's already there, and that's going to play itself out as a person ages. And what our research looks at from a life course developmental standpoint is how life course events can influence behavior over time. And what you end up with then is a malleability, individuals change, enormous heterogeneity over the life course, unpredictability, and so forth. So it seems to me that we just can't use these markers to determine what people are going to look like from childhood to later adulthood.
John Paul Wright, would your research with adoptees reinforce what John Loeb was just saying?
Well, I think our research in general, I think we would say that we agree in part with Professor Loeb that, you know, it is very difficult to, you know, look forward into the future, even with the data at hand, and say, well, you know, person X is going to be a high-rate offender and person Y is not going to be. There are many intervening mechanisms. And I think Professor Loeb's work with Professor Sampson has gone a long way in elucidating some of those mechanisms. That said, there is also appears to be a pathway, although it is not a perfect pathway, where children who very early in life who show very high degrees of problem behavior, who are not controllable, who are highly impulsive, seem to be frequently set on a life course that just builds deficits, if you will, that creates problems along the way and that divorces them from many possible pro-social opportunities. And it's particularly those children that we're concerned with, work by Terry Moffitt and her husband, Aswan Caspi,
what's the chicken and egg there? Mm-hmm. Because if you have a child who at three has a tendency mm-hmm. towards some kind of aggressive or antisocial behavior, couldn't it well be that they end up in an environment where they are more exposed to further aggressive and antisocial behavior, that it's harder for them to be integrated, and that if they had been if they had not had that behavior, they could have led a perfectly mm-hmm. peaceful and crime-free life?
Most certainly. If you look in early childhood, one of the predictors of who the most aggressive children are is peer rejection. Early in life, young children who are very aggressive are socially excluded from pro-social peer groups. That's an important key element in understanding how their lives are unfolding, because it also cuts them off from pro-social opportunities and pro-social learning environments that we think could potentially sway their propensity, whatever that propensity may be. But those are the people that we're worried about. We're worried about the life course persistent, the people that start early, accelerate offending, engage in a wide variety of crimes later in life, and who are slow to desist. That's the primary group of offenders that are responsible for the majority of crimes in our society.
Okay, Benson Cook, would you say then that if we look at that group of children who have a predisposition perhaps very early on towards some sort of aggressive behavior, then they get, as a psychologist I'm asking mm-hmm. you, and then they get into a situation where they might be socially isolated. Which is it that you would say is the more likely to determine whether they end up committing a crime? The fact that they've been socially isolated because of their behavior or some sort of genetic predisposition towards violence?
I like to take this conversation and kind of contextualize it in a way that is relevant for me. As I'm listening, I think about the fact that I grew up in a single-parent family. I think about the fact that I grew up in the projects. I think about the fact that early on in my pre-adolescent years, I moved into a predominantly white neighborhood where I was isolated. Okay, I was told by my teachers that I would never amount to anything. But look at me now.
I'm not witnessing a huge amount of aggressive behavior, I have to say, in the studio.
Exactly. And so I guess my point is, it's really important to understand some of the cultural issues. For example, one of the things, again, I mentioned before, the importance of having African-American geneticists, PhDs, sitting at the table formulating the initial conversations on this. I think that that's really...
And if that happened, would you be...
If they're culturally sensitive to the issues that impact the African-American community, I think that some of the things that I'm talking about will come out. Case in point, there's a book called Medical Apartheid, written by Harriet Washington, that really provides an excellent historical overview from pre-slavery, slavery up into the 20th century, of many of the misdeeds that have been done by the medical community in terms of this particular conversation we're having now. Has this group studied that? Has this group looked at some of the work that has been done around the Tuskegee experiment? And there are many others, because that's the point that I think I'm conveying as the president of the Association of Black Psychologists, that is the elephant in the room that people oftentimes are unwilling to speak to.
Okay, I'm not quite clear whether you are suggesting that any research linking or suggesting that there is a genetic link with criminology, you think is going to be somehow subjective or unrepresentative or unreliable?
I'm saying that there is information that I have not read about in the work that's been currently done that speaks to the issue of cultural mistrust that is very prevalent from our professional orientation.
John Lobb, is it possible to marry the cultural, political, historical sensitivities with some sort of scientific genetic research that comes up with a, I hate to use the word true, but a result that we can say is pure fact?
Well, I think I have a slightly different take on that question. And Dr. Wright alluded to the life course persistent offender. And this is a prominent theory within criminology that talks about a small group of kids who have a number of risk factors that then they commit crime virtually in every decade of their life. And that's a very provocative theory. We believe we have data that can look at that empirically. And because of the men we studied, as adolescents and as children, they had many of the characteristics of life course persisters. However, once they became serious delinquents, then you try to prospectively look at what happens them to life. We see that all of those eventually desist over time. And so they do not continue in a life of crime. In fact, they are able to stop committing offending. And that's because we believe because of turning points in their life. Those turning points could be cultural context. Those turning points could be salient life events like marriage, like work, like serving in the military. Lives could be turned around. And we think that's a very important message in this whole story of looking at genetics and crime.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wmu.org, find us on Facebook, or send us a tweet as well. Let's go to the phones now to Tony in St. Louis, Missouri. Tony, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
G'day, good timing. I was drafted into the military in our worst year of war since the Korean War. And so my question is the genetic test for those who will not kill your family if their masters order them to? Or is it for a test for those who do kill when their masters order them?
Tony, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there because I'm not sure that we're talking about whether people are going to kill as masters at all. But, the question I suppose is whether the testing is for people that will commit a crime, or are we testing for people that won't commit a crime? And is there making a difference, John Lobb?
I think that what my understanding of the research, and I'm not a behavioral geneticist, but the research that's looking at genetic basis for criminal behavior is simply looking at whether or not there are unique markers that distinguish people who offend versus those who don't. And has been brought up in this discussion, how we define who offends, our definition of crime, our population that we use to study that are absolutely crucial in terms of understanding the answer to that question.
Okay, we can go now to Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He joins us from the University of Pennsylvania, Professor of Bioethics and Philosophy. Dr. Kaplan, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the discussion that we've been having so far on the role that genes might play in predicting criminal behavior. I wanted to get your reaction.
Well, I'm nervous about the study of genetics with respect to crime, not so much that scientists themselves can't be precise in saying here's a particular behavior that might then lead to crime, whether it's something like aggression or a lack of self-control, but I worry a great deal about how this will be heard by policymakers, politicians, who historically have come away from these discussions thinking, aha, so there is a crime gene. Now, we know that crime as a category covers everything from selling drugs and in some parts of the world being a political dissident to historically being the wrong race, religion, or member of an ethnic group.
But hold on one second, because you're suggesting, it seems to me, that the research might be valid, but you're worried about how it will be used. But
precisely,
does that mean that we shouldn't do the research?
Well, I think the research needs to be done, but it needs to be done with, I'll call it, extreme modesty and excess caution about publication and precision in what you say publicly. And that becomes very important. Look, in one sense, genes influence just about everything. I sit on a number of groups that are trying to set standards for understanding how people react to different drugs, common drugs like Plavix or warfarin, Coumadin, that people take. And we know that people have side effects from those drugs, and some people metabolize them quickly. It's clear that that is mainly a genetic trait, but even there, small differences in genetic makeup can make a huge difference to how you make claims about who's likely to be a high metabolizer of drugs or low metabolizer.
Do you see any positive benefit in this research?
Well, I think it's important to understand the genetic basis of behavior. I think that it plays a role. But if we look at the incarceration rate, just for the United States, the highest in the world, probably approximating 800 people per 100,000, I don't think you need to do a scientific study to come to understand crime. It's a function of jobs, it's a function of economy, it's a function of opportunity, it's a function of sentencing and the kind of criminal justice system you have. Yes, biology counts, but I don't want to see our policymakers running off saying, the thing to do is genetically test everyone.
Okay, Dr. Arthur Kaplan joining us from Pennsylvania. Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
The life and legacy of pioneering investigative journalist Lincoln Steffens. His reporting changed journalism, but came with a steep personal price. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our conversation on genetics and criminology, and during the break I received this email from Jackie, who writes, "As a child, I was excitable, impulsive, hot-tempered, judgmental, aggressive, had minimally educated parents, was very poor, and African-American. Guess that's why I became a lawyer." Jackie, thanks for that. Let's go to the phones again to Alex in Birmingham, Alabama. Alex, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I guess my question involves some of the racial issues around this. My question is, since African Americans do make up about 80% of the current prison population, is it more of a nature or is it more of a nurture? Is it really a crime gene, or because African Americans in the ghetto do grow up in a culture of crime, are they more likely to commit crimes themselves, external to genetic factors?
Okay, I think that's what we're trying to sort out during the course of this discussion, nature or nurture. Let me start with you, Benson.
I would say that it's not either of those. I'm drawn to an image that many people may remember after Hurricane Katrina. The Associated Press had two articles, and when I do presentations, I show them. One was a picture of a white man and a white woman, and it said, "Two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store." And a few hours later, there was an African-American male And in that picture, it said a young man walks through chest deep water after looting the grocery store. So here you have a perception of crime that was very prevalent during that particular horrific period following Hurricane Katrina.
Well, there was some crime during that period.
Here's the point. The point is the perception. How is it that two individuals who are also who are taking food from the store can be perceived as finding it? Another individual taking food from the store is looting. And oftentimes this kind of perception creates an image that law enforcement oftentimes have suspicions on. And this has been true for me. I've walked in different stores and I get followed around. Now, is it because I have a doctorate degree? You know, no. Is it because I'm wearing oftentimes a suit and tie, which is my usual attire? No. It's probably because I'm African American. One time I even inquired about it, and I was told that that was in fact the case. So part of what I guess I'm getting at is that it's really important that we recognize the impact that oppression often plays in the perception that people have of the differences that exist with one group over the other, which is one of the reasons, again, referring to Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, why you have a disproportionately higher number of African-American males incarcerated.
John Loeb, can I pick up on what Alex was saying from Alabama there?
Yes, I would I'd probably say it's nature, nurture, and more. And I think one of the things we've learned over the last 25 years is that crime results from a multiplicity of factors, individual characteristics that may well be linked to genetics or early childhood socialization. Family socialization is very important, peer group interactions, schools, communities, and indeed nations writ large. And I think it goes back to this basic point about given the multiple factors and the multiple pathways that lead people to criminal behavior, that's what we have to be open to. I want to go back, though, to a point that, Dr. Kaplan made, and I think it's very important. It should not be lost. I think modesty in terms of how we approach this research is extremely important, and I think also being honest in terms of public speaking about it. One of the reasons I'm sitting in this chair is because I believe, as the director of the National Institute of Justice, the research and development arm in the Department of Justice, we should focus on the best science that's used for the field. And that's why I was willing to come on the show. And that's an important piece to, for people who are in policy positions to speak honestly about this very important issue.
But you are speaking about it. And one of the things that struck me about what Dr. Kaplan was saying was that, in a sense, he was saying, okay, do the research. But he was almost saying, but keep a lid on it, wasn't he?
Well, what I heard him saying was put the research in a context. And again, I think that this is
which is what Benson has been saying.
Exactly. And this is why I'm here wearing essentially two hats, right? It's the head of the National Institute of Justice, the research development arm of the Department of Justice, but I'm also here as a life course criminologist that's done research on longitudinal studies of how people move in and out of crime, which I think adds an important piece to this discussion.
Well, Professor John Paul Wright, are you concerned about how the research, because amongst us you've done specific research on this with your adoptees, are you concerned about the policy implications of the research that you've done?
I'll make two points. First, to echo what Professor Laub said, that it's better that we talk about this than not talk about it. It's better that we know than don't know. It's better that we pursue rigorous science, whether it's genetic or purely social. I would like to see the standards of modesty applied throughout the research base. Sometimes that doesn't happen on either side of the research spectrum. In terms of policy consequences, I'd like to first say that the massive increases that we've witnessed in incarceration in the United States occurred wholly independently of any biological theorizing. That if you look at what modern biological theorizing on human behavior talks about, they emphasize, for example, early intervention with children, nurse home visitation programs, and perhaps even in certain situations, pharmaceutical types of interventions. You know, we have entire classes of drugs that have literally saved the lives of millions of people who suffer from depression and anxiety and other types of disorders. That otherwise, if we had simply buried our heads in the sand and done nothing, we would not have been effective in our intervention efforts. I think some of the same things can be said about behavior. One of the leading causes of parents seeking help for their children is the It's not just misbehavior. It's a very difficult and taxing behavior. It's behavior that they cannot control or regulate, and they seek help for that. And I think eventually over time, there may be better social interventions as well as better pharmaceutical interventions that will lead overall, I think, to a better quality of life for the people involved.
Okay, let's
crime destroys families, and you know the involvement, the taxing behavior of children places enormous stress on families, and I think the interventions there are potentially both social and even pharmaceutical in some situations.
Let's go to Maggie, who joins us from Fort Worth, Texas. Maggie, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, great topic, and I think terms that you've mentioned so far, context and policy, are critical in this. As I've listened, I'm reminded of a couple of books that I've read or seen. Foucault's book, Madness and Civilization, is high-minded thinking about how one culture, the dominant culture, views the other, the weaker, and they perceive madness, they perceive crime, in somebody who is incredibly different. And then there's the issue of the whole social Darwinist pseudoscience that took place. I have a book I found in an estate years ago from 1877 called The Jukes. And it literally is supposedly a study of a criminal family. It's called A Study in Crime, Pauperism, Disease, and Heredity, and further studies of criminals. This is a discussion that's been going along for a long time, so I think you must have to be very careful to not wade back into some of those waters.
John Locke.
Well, I think that the caller is absolutely right. I mean, there's been a history of the history of criminology can be summed up in The Search for the Criminal Man. And she refers to a classic book by Richard Dugdale, which looked at a criminal family and tried to make linkages across multiple generations with respect to criminal behavior. I do think that this is something, though, that we can't just kind of ignore because, as Dr. Kaplan said, we're looking at the effects of genes on a variety of behaviors. We're learning a lot more. I agree with Dr. Wright that the methods, particularly the direct measures of genetics, is much better today. But at the same time, I think, as the caller pointed out, it's all about context, and we need to take very seriously the importance of social context as we move forward.
I want to read an email that came to us from Lisa. Lisa writes, have the researchers done any sibling studies regarding crime, that is, siblings of similar age, same parents and same upbringing, who have different behaviors in regard to crime? I know families like this and always marvel at how one sibling can be uncriminal, she says normal, and the other turn out to be a criminal. Do we know, Dr. Wright, why this happens?
Well,
I mean, it gets a little bit back to what Maggie was calling us about from Texas.
Absolutely. And we have known for a very long time that crime runs in families. About 10% of all families produce anywhere from 60 to 80% of all serious offenders. We've known this since literally the 1800s when we started keeping, when records on this were first looked at. That's not changed. We find this in England. We find this in the United States. There are studies in other countries in Europe. We find the same thing. So it is true that there are some families that appear to be far more crime prone, if you will, over generations. That said, if we look within families, there's oftentimes tremendous diversity in terms of behaviors and traits by between children born within the same family. Some of the some Nobel laureates have come from families with sort of very chaotic backgrounds and very turbulent types of backgrounds. Some of the worst psychopaths have come from very middle class or upper class families. So yes, there's tremendous diversity, and some of our work has tried to understand how do you get such a range of behavioral differences within largely the same socialization context. And part of that answer, I think, is probably just that the children are different coming out, that when they enter the world, they're not blank slates. They have some degree of neurological substructures that make them more or less temperamental, more or less hyperactive, more or less open to novelty-seeking, what have you. and that these things simply do play out, although sometimes they are modifiable within the home environment. But taken at the extreme, yes, we do see tremendous differences between children born to the same parents.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to call us, do call 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. Benson Cook, I want to pick up on what John Paul Wright was saying there. When you, as a psychologist, see families like that and you see very different behavior in different members of families, what are you looking at?
Well,
or looking for, perhaps?
One of the things that becomes important is contextualizing the history of the culture. For example, in the New York Times article, there was a statement that talked about how marriage may serve as a switch that directs male energies toward investing in a family rather than competing with other males. What I found very interesting about that is historically, for African Americans, there was a period during enslavement and Jim Crow where we were jumping the broom because it was not legal for us to be married. So we created a different type of family structure. So how would genetics play out in terms of understanding what we needed to do to be able to persist in an oppressive environment? I mean, how would one particularly look at that? Again, contextualizing becomes really important. I want to extrapolate this one article that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 1999 that looked at the effect of race and sex on physicians' recommendations for a medical procedure, cardiac catheterization. And what was interesting from this particular article, which also appeared on a Nightline episode with Ted Koppel, is that they showed that using one of the largest studies ever done, using African-American man-woman, Caucasian man-woman, physicians looking at a computer-generated assessment, that the African Americans were denied the form of treatment that could save their lives versus others. And it was based upon the cultural bias that they had as to who would benefit from the particular service. So it's really important, again, for African Americans to be sitting at the table, having the conversation about the historical context of where cultural mistrust exists around this particular issue. It's just really important that we recognize the value of being able to include that in the conversation.
I want to include a tweet in the conversation from Willis, who writes to us, "The way this conversation is going leads me to believe that the guests leave no room for free will." What can they say about that, John?
Oh, I think there is room for free will in that what we found in our work was not only did social events change people's lives, like getting married, joining the military, finding a good job. But we also found that the men sometimes took very specific agentic action to make those opportunities happen. So one of the serious delinquents...
Deliberate actions.
One of the serious delinquents recognized that he was in a bad neighborhood in Boston. He knew he had to get out, otherwise he'd be dead by the age of 20. He took his cousin's Social Security number and joined the military. Went overseas...
Technically a crime.
Exactly. But he knew what he had to do. Others were made conscious decisions to move out of the neighborhood and so forth. So we, in life course criminology writ large, allows opportunity for agentic actions by individuals.
I would agree with that if I can jump in.
Go ahead.
There is plenty of room for agency and free will, even with biological influences. If, for example, we look at alcoholism, there's very good evidence that alcoholism has a biological basis. We do not say to alcoholics, suffering alcoholics, well, it's biological, there's nothing you can do about it. We say to them, you have to own this, that there's a 12-step program that you can engage in, that there are specific ways of living your life that you'll have to make accommodations to. And then we attempt to set up the support networks around them to help them make those types of decisions. I spoke with one alcoholic who had a lengthy criminal history, had spent much of his juvenile and adult life in prison, and had for the last 15 years been quite a successful citizen. I asked him, what changed? His response, and I'll never forget it, was, he said, I'm a thief, a liar, and if you push me too far, I may kill you. He said, I'm all of those things, but I'm not today. And his point was, I have a choice. His point was that he had taken it upon himself to redefine himself And I think that is the power of human agency, that understanding our propensities, understanding our proclivities, gives us information to make better choices.
John Paul Wright, a very good point to end on. Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Cincinnati. I've also had in the studio with me Dr. Benson George Cook, President of the Association of Black Psychologists, Dr. John Lobb, Director of the National Institute of Justice at the U.S. Department of Justice, has also been here again. Dr. Lobb, thank you, and congratulations on your Stockholm Award. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.